This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, focus on Africa, the tragic stalemate and violence in South Sudan. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. In view of the resumption of hostilities in South Sudan, which has raised fears of a slide back into civil war in the world's youngest nation, the UN Security Council recently authorized the deployment of an extra 4,000 troops to serve as a protection force in the capital, Juba. The authorization follows heavy fighting last month in Juba that left hundreds of people dead. The UN peacekeeping force in South Sudan was criticized for failing to protect civilians at UN sites. The UN resolution threatens South Sudan with an arms embargo if it does not cooperate. The new troops would fall under the command of the existing 12,000-strong UN mission known as UNMISS. Political differences and a subsequent power struggle between President Salva Kiir and Vice President Riek Machar first erupted into conflict in late 2013. A peace deal meant to end the fighting was signed in August of 2015, but sporadic clashes continue, slowing its implementation. The rift between the two groups is deep, exacerbated by ethnic overtones between the Dinka tribe, to which Kiir belongs, and Nuer, Machar's tribe. Well, with us to discuss South Sudan's downward spiral and other trending stories on the African continent are two distinguished African analysts who are no strangers at these VOA microphones. Jennifer Cook is director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and that's a Washington-based think tank. And J. Peter Pham, he's director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, and that's a policy group also based in Washington. And both panelists join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Carol.
Well, Jennifer, let me begin with you, and let's talk about this UN approval for another 4,000 troops for South Sudan to reinforce the already 12,000-strong peacekeeping force. What prompted this extraordinary call for more troops?
Well, one is that the agreement between Salva Kiir and Riek Machar has fallen apart, and the country is indeed sliding into very brutal, terrible violence. And the peacekeeping force at present, as you said, has come under a lot of criticism for not doing enough to step out and help civilians. I'm not entirely sure that sheer numbers are going to help solve the problem. There has to also be a firm commitment to the mandate to protect civilians. And that is going to be, as it is in every peacekeeping case where there is a hot conflict going on, that's going to be very difficult to enforce. So this will not be resolved simply through deployment of more peacekeepers. There has to be some fundamental change in the incentives for the two leaders. There has to be some discipline among the South Sudan government forces that are completely undisciplined, violent, and have meted out egregious abuses against civilians.
Indeed. Well, turning to you, J. Peter Pham, for your take on the reason for the extra troops, and piggybacking off of what Jennifer said, we did witness this last month of July an attack in Juba on foreigners, aid workers by troops, presumably under Salva Kiir's command, and reports of calls for help by foreign aid workers went unheeded by UN forces. So a perceived failure by the UN peacekeeping force to uphold its core mandate of protecting civilians not very far away. So that raises the question that Jennifer raised, which is, why would more troops make any difference?
Well, that's the question. Interestingly, the United Nations Security Council in this new resolution, 2304, actually increases not only the number of troops with an additional 4,000 troops to the 12,000 that are already there, but more specifically invokes its Chapter 7 powers to grant a new mandate, an additional mandate, to a force that has been challenged, to put it mildly, in fulfilling its existing mandate. This additional mandate is to actually enforce the peace and to bring those who are pushing conflict to heel. Now, the question is not the authorities, but whether there's the political will, both on the part of the United Nations system and on the part of the troops on the ground and their commanders, to actually take up the mandate that's been given to them. That's question one. Question two, as Jennifer rightly pointed out, is the question of the absolute failure in leadership on the part of the leaders of South Sudan. And I think primary responsibility has to be assigned to the government, the President Salva Kiir. In fact, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Prince Zayed Raad Al Husseini, the independent report that he has put out places a majority of the incidents of sexual violence and killings, the responsibility on the part of pro-regime or pro-President Salva Kiir forces. And that's something that we have to take into account. Then thirdly, I think we have to look at fundamentally this conflict, which has gone on, the fact that peace agreements have been signed and withered away virtually from day one, and ask ourselves if we're not perhaps witnessing in this a total failure on the part of the leadership of South Sudan, and whether perhaps some more drastic action needs to be done. And we can't simply paper things over any longer. And I think whether there's the political will for that on the part of the international community remains to be seen. The one positive thing I would say in all this has been that finally it's beginning to take its toll on neighboring countries. That's not a good thing, but it's also forcing the neighboring countries to look at their own interests and therefore demand action rather than passively let things slide.
Well, back to you, Jennifer Cook, to see to what extent the UN peacekeeping force will take a different stand given the Chapter 7 status. What about the leadership? I mean, if they haven't been able to agree to compromise, you know, until now, what makes us believe that they will be able to go forward? And what are other actors responsible for, whether it's the neighbors or the international community or even the United States?
Well, that's the problem, is that just the term peacekeeping means that you're there to keep a peace. And peace enforcement is a little stronger, but it still has the notion that there's some kind of agreement in place. In this, there is not. They have been violated again and again. It's not even clear that the two top protagonists in this, you know, carry the authority and control of other groups within South Sudan. And so it's not clear that they could even negotiate some kind of peace, even if they were willing. So it's a huge short-sightedness on the part of the leadership. I always think of two men holding each other's throats as they slowly squeeze themselves to death, and nobody wins in the end. I think Peter's right that the regional states, which may have some more influence, Ethiopia, for example, Uganda, really have to step up in terms of pressure. I think China also has a big role to play, and its peacekeepers did not do so well, and two were actually killed in recent months. But, you know, one thing that this has done, I think, is take the veil off just how ill-equipped this country was and is to govern itself. And they claimed with great pride the mantle of sovereignty, but they've shown no ability to govern. And I think in that instance, there has to be some quid pro quo that you have to show responsibility or you lose some of your sovereignty, especially when we have peacekeepers putting their lives on the ground to put this place back together.
Lose some of your sovereignty.
Well, you know, you can't claim it if you can't make it happen.
So what would the implications of that be?
Well, that would be very controversial, obviously. But you cannot say that Salva Kiir is a legitimate government at this point. I think it would take a more interventionist approach. I think it's quite amazing that the arms embargo has not yet been imposed and that we're still kind of holding out some fiction that this is a sovereign government that should be able to procure its arms.
Well, that leads me to ask you then, Peter Pham, what about that we've heard about this call for an arms embargo? Even if these troops go there under the new mandate, perhaps an arms embargo is necessary. Well, what are your thoughts in regard to the next step for this horrible, unending conflict?
First of all, an arms embargo is long overdue. I can't believe that any objective analysis would conclude that any good is to be had by more arms flowing into South Sudan. But unfortunately, such is the nature of diplomacy. In order to get the consensus at the United Nations, to get four countries to abstain, China, Russia, Venezuela, and Egypt, and the other 11 to agree to the resolution, they had to put the arms embargo aside to simply threaten it. But I think the time will come for it, and it needs to come. Secondly, Jennifer makes an excellent point on the sovereignty issue. Sovereignty isn't about simply having a flag to wave around and a national anthem to sing. Modern sovereignty includes political legitimacy, providing basic protections and security to your own citizens, and not being a nuisance and, in fact, a threat to the security of your neighbors. All three counts of which South Sudan, if it ever had those qualities, certainly they're long gone. And for Salva Kiir to invoke national sovereignty against the deployment of additional UN peacekeepers and to say, as he did recently, he's going to refer the matter to his rump national parliament, I mean, talking about South Sudan's sovereignty in this context makes about as much sense as talking about the virtues of a sex worker. Both are works of fiction. The reality is your sovereignty ends where your neighbor's security and the basic human security of your own citizens is touched upon, which raises the final question for which the international community has dodged to date, is whether we have before us interlocutors capable or even willing, just to address President Salva Kiir. In the space of a few short years, he's twice now been damned by the international community for provoking a conflict. The claim that there was a coup attempt in December 2013, which is the beginning of the civil war, has been debunked widely, including by the highest levels of the U.S. government. And now the UN reports placing the main onus for the atrocities in recent weeks, again, on forces nominally under his control. And now he wants to call a snap election after having bombed out his opponent's home. I think we're seeing a creeping authoritarianism that certainly lacks the legitimacy as that's requisite for modern sovereignty.
Well, speaking of sovereignty, once again, back to you, Jennifer Cook. So what does the international community do at this point if this just continues, notwithstanding the extra peacekeeping troops, and even if an arms embargo is enforced eventually?
Its leverage is limited. Look, this is a government that we helped birth, and this was perhaps one of the mistakes that has led to this. They have always known that the U.S. has our back, whatever we do. And I think that was been a mistake for a long time. So putting conditionalities on how we assist.
The United States is still the largest provider of foreign assistance. So we must have a certain amount of leverage.
Well, it doesn't matter if the leaders don't care that citizens are getting brutally murdered. They don't care if they starve to death or if they're killed by government forces. So that doesn't get us much leverage. The one thing that may happen is that resources begin to run out. The oil production is down. Eventually, the funding and the patronage networks that keep the army together may fall out, but that will not be a smooth and happy transition when it does happen. I have to say, I think the situation is just extremely bleak right now.
Peter?
I think at some point the international community has to acknowledge not only its responsibility because of the humanitarian challenge that's faced in South Sudan today, with the number of people facing food insecurity, number of people displaced, the refugees flows, the scope for mischief in the region, but because, as Jennifer pointed out, the international community has a responsibility, a moral responsibility, even if it doesn't acknowledge it, for having birthed this nation into being. And without the institutions to enable it to survive its infancy. There are precedents from other parts of the world. For example, if we looked at what happened in the Balkans in the 1990s, the rather robust role the international community took in building up institutions and exercising a bit of oversight in Bosnia-Herzegovina, the role the Europeans played in particular in Kosovo. I don't think the political will is there quite yet, but perhaps some role with the African Union, others playing a lead in it, of guardianship of South Sudan, given the failure of its own leadership, to build the institutions necessary so that people can have differences and deal with those differences, resolve them in a nonviolent fashion. But that's a work of years, not of weeks or months. And right now, I'm afraid the political will and the material resources just aren't there for it.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Jennifer Cook. She's director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. That's a think tank based here in Washington. And J. Peter Pham, from whom you just heard. He's director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, also based in Washington. We're discussing the descent into chaos in South Sudan as the UN approves more peacekeeping troops. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener from Enugu State in Nigeria, Ozugu Ifananya. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, speaking of Nigeria, Jennifer, let's go to Nigeria. Boko Haram, the militant group, released a video last week purporting to show
bodies of several kidnapped schoolgirls, those schoolgirls that were kidnapped a couple of years ago in Chibok. The fighter demanded the release of imprisoned militants on the part of the government in exchange for the release of the girls. What do you think this says about Boko Haram's either strength, weakness, and Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari's offensive against Boko Haram?
Well, I think broadly, Boko Haram is weakened. Its leadership is fracturing. The command structure is disintegrating. It has lost thousands of members, either killed, captured, or surrendered, no longer controls territory. It is being reduced to kind of very asymmetrical attacks against extremely soft targets. All this has meant that the battleground for Boko Haram has moved into the realm of propaganda and kind of warring videos. And it's an information war at a time that physically and militarily they are extremely weak. Boko Haram fighters are starving. I just came back from Maiduguri, talked to a number of the civilian joint task force folks. A lot of the raids currently are just to get food for the fighters. So it's a propaganda move. It's gotten the group back on the headlines. It kind of shifts the narrative and says, well, A, don't airbomb us because you'll be killing the girls, and B, it's your fault if the girls die. You know, we don't know how much is real in that video to begin with. It's not clear that the girls were killed by airstrikes. We don't know when the video was taken. It's some of the girls, not all of the girls.
So, J. Peter, from a war of videos, a propaganda war, how do you see this release of this latest video and what it says about Boko Haram?
I agree with Jennifer that Boko Haram, the movement as a whole, is certainly considerably weakened. They've lost the territory. Militarily, they're significantly weakened. And there's a fracture. There's been the so-called Islamic State appointed a new leader for Boko Haram, Abu Musab al-Barnawi, and the former leader, Abu Bakr Shekau, who had not been heard from for some time, that made himself heard from and contested this, although he was the one who initiated the allegiance to the Islamic State in the first place. He didn't like his firing. And this video has to be understood in that power struggle. So in that respect, clearly the group is on the wane at that level. On the other hand, I would caution, this is a group who throughout its history has proven remarkably resilient. They're losing on one battlefield, they move to a different battlefield where you're not ready for them. So the video itself, to me, shows a group that, yes, is down on the heels, but resilient insofar as they managed to produce a relatively decent quality video. They also responded with very clever talking points, the claims of the victims, which, again, I'm not an expert on forensics, but they don't look like bombing victims that I've seen in real life and in videos before. But they also produced a young girl. Interestingly enough, her mother was one of those who spoke out openly just a few months ago in the second anniversary of the kidnapping. Of all the girls to pick up to be singled out, they picked that one. So they're responding very cleverly, tugging at the right heartstring. So it's a group that clearly is weakened militarily and strategically, but it is shifting its terrain of combat, and it's showing, once again, a remarkable capability for adapting. So until they're finally terminated as a group, I think we have to be careful about proclaiming victories, technical or otherwise, against Boko Haram.
Back to you, Jennifer Cook. How would you assess President Muhammadu Buhari's offensive against Boko Haram? Is he indeed making progress? And what about the calls by mothers of the girls, you know, for some kind of dialogue with Boko Haram to try to get the girls back? I mean, of course, nobody wants to give in to blackmail and release, you know, Boko Haram prisoners. But how do you square all of that?
Beginning in the last year of the Jonathan administration, the momentum did shift. The military forces began a much more concerted push along with regional partners. And President Buhari has moved that along. I think the morale of the military is improving. They moved the command base to Maiduguri. You can walk around Maiduguri feeling fairly safe, and business is kind of coming back there. So there has been major progress. The one place I think he has not put as much emphasis is in the communication strategy to the people of the Northeast, victims, and to Nigerians broadly, and in terms of a more kind of comprehensive community engagement. He's also facing problems in the Delta, facing problems with the Fulani herdsmen attacks. So he's got a lot of multiple pressures. In terms of giving in to the kidnappers, negotiations like this can take many years. You don't want to release Boko Haram fighters. And any kind of rush to rescue the girls is likely to end up with many girls dead. So they're moving in the right direction collaboratively with regional troops. But as Peter said, you know, unless you have that much bigger approach, these kind of factions and rivalries and alliances may very well regroup and reemerge.
Okay, and Peter, quickly from you, your assessment of how Muhammadu Buhari is doing, whether on the battlefield or hearts and minds, any economic progress that could dissuade anybody from moving toward Boko Haram or joining their forces?
By and large, I think everyone has to credit the progress that's been made under the Buhari administration, building up on the belated progress at the tail end of the Goodluck Jonathan administration. But this is a complex game with multiple moving parts. For example, as Boko Haram is pushed back, there is going to be the push to get people back to their communities, etc. Some won't want to move. Others will move, and how do we supply them? Do we create a new humanitarian challenge? And of course, getting supplies to people being resettled creates opportunities for asymmetric attacks by the remnants of Boko Haram. So it's a complex thing, and it needs a holistic strategy. And thus far, we've yet to see such a strategy articulated, and that's of concern.
Well, back to you, Jennifer, as we close. One quick reaction from you on Angola, another oil-rich country like Nigeria. Price of oil, though, plummeting. Last decade, Angola was on top of the world. The government declared that Luanda would be the new Dubai, but oil prices have crashed, and they're having a major impact on one of Africa's richest and most unequal countries. We're seeing incidents of yellow fever, malaria. People are dying of preventable illnesses. And we've known for a long time that the government is very corrupt. They do not share the wealth, but it's getting worse and worse. Where do you see Angola going?
They are paying now for the sins of the past. Nigeria, it relies very heavily on oil revenues for government revenues. But in the economy writ large, oil is just 14% of the GDP. Whereas in Angola, it's a much bigger percent. I think it's 45, almost 50% of the country's GDP. So there's a much narrower economic base to build on. The other thing is obviously the levels of corruption and nepotism and this very conspicuous consumption in a small group, a familial group around the President Dos Santos, that I think even people within the ruling party are beginning to get very fed up with if they're not in that inner tight circle. And then civilians who are seeing housing, food, water, health, education, all these things disintegrate around them in really abject poverty, beginning to speak out. And the government's reaction is then to crack down. They're also heading into an election eventually. And so rather than kind of open up and serve the citizens who are hurting, the government is kind of knuckling down and tamping down any kind of dissent. So it's kind of locked in this downward spiral politically.
All right. We'll certainly have to have another program devoted solely to Angola in the near future. But as we close, Peter Pham, I'd like to get your reaction on the recent elections in Zambia. There was an election on August 11th. Incumbent Edgar Lungu defeated his challenger by a very thin margin. It was just enough to avoid a runoff. European Union poll observers declared the election largely free and fair. On the other hand, there's been a lot of violence on the part of the opposition. What's the significance of this election for Zambia and the region, and what do you make of the dispute and the ensuing violence?
Zambia has a long history of being a relatively stable country, free and vigorous election campaigns and peaceful transitions. This last election, however, marked a significant departure. Levels of violence were not as great as in some African countries, but significant by Zambian standards. In fact, very significant. And then there's the razor-thin margin of victory. The president won just over 50%, just, you know, literally a hair's breadth away from having to do a second round. And the opposition is arguing that there was some funny monkey business going on. There has been no evidence produced of that, but that type of aspersion cast in this tense environment, it really depends on what happens when the vote is finally certified and whether people will accept the verdict of having lost narrowly or whether there's going to be violence. So I think it's at a tipping point. It's an inflection point for the country. And in that respect, because of the sense of region, Southern Africa, that Zambia is in, it's also an important moment for the region.
And on that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Jennifer Cook, Director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and J. Peter Pham, Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council. Thanks so much to both of you for your wonderful insights.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Carol.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Jiang Wong. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter.
on The Voice of America.